This week, South Africa prepares to send envoys to Washington to discuss Vladimir Putin. Will the Russian leader attend the BRICS summit in Durban later this year? Will South African President Cyril Ramaphosa face pressure to host Putin or hand him over to The Hague? Also, the Pentagon is reeling from a major intelligence leak after dozens of top secret files appear online. We'll discuss the damage and the fallout. And my interview with Chris Maroleng from Good Governance Africa about the rise in populism, threats to democracy, and what governance has to do with it. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Heidi Adams, coming to you from VOA's headquarters in Washington. It is so great to be with you. And we begin with a look at the stories and events that are making headlines. It's time for our reporter segment. And joining me right here in studio is VOA's Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb. And also with us is Tatenda Gumbo. She's the digital lead in VOA's English to Africa news service. Also joining us from Johannesburg, South Africa, is Govan Whittles. He's a correspondent for VOA affiliate news station, Newsroom Africa. Govan, Tatenda, and Carla, a warm welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Govan, I'm going to start with you because there's so much happening on the diplomatic front. Of course, President Cyril Ramaphosa to send envoys to Washington to discuss one person, Vladimir Putin. Now, of course, this comes ahead of the BRICS summit. And just a reminder for our viewers, the BRICS nations are Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. They're set to meet in August in Durban, South Africa. And of course, there are big questions around whether the Russia's leader, Vladimir Putin, will actually attend in person. Govan, tell us, what is President Cyril Ramaphosa's dilemma here? And what does he want his envoys to come and tell the Biden-Harris administration?
Well, it's a 400 billion rand dilemma that the South African president faces. That's the value of the U.S.'s trade with South Africa. And at the core of this, essentially, is the Africa Growth and Opportunities Act, AGOA, which is responsible for at least $54 million worth of trade with South Africa. It provides South Africa duty-free access, duty and quota-free access to the American market. And it's due to expire in 2025, just two years from now. And what's interesting about this is that the BRICS summit will be closely followed by an AGOA summit. Now, trade really is at the center of all of this, because as much as a diplomatic fallout looms at that BRICS summit, it will be felt in the trade that South Africa has with the U.S. To put it into perspective, South Africa's trade partners in the West make up more than a third of its trade, and there have been questions about how long it will be before it starts to feel the pressure from its position towards the Russia-Ukraine conflict. So the president is sending envoys to Washington principally to deal with the fallout from its position towards Russia, the fact that it not only took part in those joint military exercises, but it hosted the Lady R vessel, something we know Washington wasn't happy about, because the ministers are saying that they're perpetually or continuously engaging with some of their counterparts in Washington over that diplomatic fallout. Then, of course, there is the fact that they've stated on the 8th of April that there will be an invitation sent to Vladimir Putin to attend the BRICS summit. And then after that, they're saying that the South African government is now seeking legal advice on whether or not it would be compelled to arrest Vladimir Putin, hand him over to The Hague. They're seeking legal advice because when Omar al-Bashir, the leader of Sudan, was in South Africa and South Africa didn't arrest him, they got past that by saying that Bashir was protected by the immunity which is afforded to members of the African Union within the African Union summit venue. This time, that same immunity doesn't apply to the BRICS summit. And though the invitation has been extended to Vladimir Putin, it's not clear whether or not they'll reverse or retract that invitation and politely ask him not to come. What's also interesting about this envoy to Washington is that it will be led by Alvin Boetes. He's the Deputy Minister of International Relations here in South Africa. He's also the same person that just went to Moscow as part of an ANC delegation. That ANC delegation returning after meeting with Russia's United Party. That's Vladimir Putin's party, a party which the ANC wants to forge stronger links with. And is certainly going to be talking to as they go into the BRICS summit, because, of course, it's preceded by a meeting between the political party heads. So Alvin Boetes is now being sent to Washington to try and convince the U.S. not to take decisions that would negatively impact South Africa's trade with the U.S., even as that is an option for the U.S. due to the Countering Malign Russian Activities in Africa Act, and this bill, which has been proposed by a Republican senator to review South Africa's relationship or the U.S. relationship with South Africa.
Yeah, there's a lot there going on that front, even more now that you're talking to us. I want to get back here. Speaking of dilemmas, Kola, Bab, the U.S. officials here in Washington facing some dilemmas of their own, of course, after highly classified Pentagon documents were leaked online, posted to social media. Tell us what was leaked and how damaging is this entire saga for the United States?
Well, you mentioned damaging. I mean, this could be the most damaging leak in years that the Pentagon has had to deal with. There have been dozens of classified, secret, and top secret documents that have been leaked on all sorts of information. But the one that was capitalized on early on social media was the information coming out on the war in Ukraine. And that has been very damaging. Russia can definitely capitalize on some of this information. For example, one of the documents said listed the equipment that was promised to Ukraine, exact numbers. This is something that we don't get as reporters. We get the monetary value of this equipment and these weapons, but we don't get the numbers. The numbers that they've been promised, how many have made it already into Ukraine, how many are still waiting to get inside Ukraine. So these are things that the Russians could clearly use to their advantage. However, it's also very clear that some of the documents have been altered. For example, there was one document that listed the number of Russian casualties and the Ukrainian casualties. The number of Russian casualties was much smaller than what we reporters have been reporting on, and to a point where it was quite obvious that this had been doctored. And so we are still having to figure out when you see these documents, you have to assess, okay, first of all, are they valid? And second of all, have they been doctored? Because that has happened on several of the documents as well.
And I mean, who stands to benefit most from this leak?
Well, clearly the Russians have an advantage on this leak. Not only are they finding out information about the war in Ukraine, but they're also making the United States look bad. I mean, this is the United States, in some instances, spying on its allies and getting information about allied partners. And so that cannot look good for the United States. On the positive side, a lot of the Ukrainian plans have been kept close to the chest by Ukraine. So one of the things that was not leaked is the plans for an expected offensive that the Ukrainians are going to launch in the spring. So it's unclear whether or not any of these documents will affect that counteroffensive that they plan on launching.
I'll come back to you for a little more on the fallout. Tatenda, moving here to the U.S. domestic front, gun violence we saw making headlines again these days following two mass shootings in the last few weeks. And then there was this furor over the treatment of two Tennessee lawmakers who stood up and protested against gun violence in their state legislature. Tell us a little bit more about what was going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, we're having this conversation on the heels of yet another mass shooting that happened in the United States state of Kentucky. But what you're talking about in Tennessee were three Democratic representatives who were reprimanded for what was called a violation of decorum. They participated in protests of the shooting that happened at a Christian school a few weeks before then. But what was interesting about this whole reprimand of these three representatives is that two of them happened to to be two young black representatives and one who is a white woman. She narrowly missed expulsion out of the state legislature, but the two, one of them who has since been reinstated, were removed and expelled from legislature. But I think what is now happening is a question of what this means for the voting electorate. We're seeing that, you know, stats show us that gun violence among children has risen 50%. And also the topic of gun violence, of course, continues to differ based off ethnicity, based off community type, based off partisan lines. And so now you have a conversation where you have the continued conversation of gun violence or gun legislature. But then now you see Gen Z, you see Gen Z kind of joining into that conversation, who have been the most affected with some of these mass shootings. And that will be the next voter electorate that's coming up in our next.
Exactly.
Yes. And data also does show that young Republicans who are Gen Z, who are millennials, are more likely than older Republicans to want some more gun control. So that might play out as we look into, you know, the elections that are coming up and what that means for this younger voter electorate. And of course, I think this whole situation in Tennessee does kind of play out to that conversation. Some of what we've been seeing on the partisan divide on gun control and some of the sentiment, even if you look at, you know, what people are saying on social media and all that, is that they're unsure whether this reprimand really does do anything or if it might have fueled this protest for, you know, talking about gun control and all that in the United States.
Goven, coming back to you, we've got just a few minutes here. So very briefly, if you can tell us about the situation going on with Zimbabwean nationals who are essentially living on edge in South Africa amid a legal fight over whether those with special permits can stay in the country or whether they will have to leave come June this year. This is important, of course, because Zimbabweans make up a huge chunk of the group of immigrants in South Africa. The issue now before the Pretoria High Court, what can you tell us?
The Pretoria High Court will decide on whether or not they will be compelled to leave at the end of June. A few NGOs and representatives of the Zimbabweans making the argument that the decision will not only violate the constitutional right of the children of the Zimbabweans holding the Zimbabwean exemption permit to the right to access to education, but it'll break up families. The representative of the holders of the Zimbabwean exemption permit estimate there are 180,000 Zimbabweans who are holding the permit, working and living in South Africa. They all have about 3 to 4 dependents on them, so this affects about 2 million Zimbabweans. In Zimbabwe, education NGOs have reported that they're ready to receive about 5,000 Zimbabwean children if they are forced to leave. The important part of the argument in court has been that the decision was taken by the South African Home Affairs Department without any consultation with the holders of these permits, and the South African Home Affairs Department is willing to receive representations on what the effect would be of this decision, which many are calling punitive, but insists that it will not reverse its decision, that it is final. It's on this basis that these organizations are making the case for the decision to be scrapped, for the permit to be extended beyond June. It has been extended twice before, but this government is now firm that it won't do so again. It'll be up to the courts to decide, and the holders of the permits are certainly hoping that the judiciary would allow them to work and live in South Africa through an extension. If they don't, the children of these holders of the permits would be declared illegal immigrants in South Africa. They would then be violated, or they would be denied the right to go to school here in South Africa. Mm-hmm. It has huge implications, not only for the employment sector. The National Employment Association of South Africa is advising Zimbabweans to urgently apply for work visas, for critical skills visas, and have a receipt from the visa facilitation services. And that would allow them to continue staying in the country and working in the country while that application is being processed. It's a stop. It's a gap measure, but it's the best that they have now, and they're awaiting an outcome in the courts.
Kolobab, I'm going to put the pressure on you here to be very, very brief just to end us off here. Any information in those Pentagon leaked documents about military secrets pertaining to African countries?
Yes, actually. Great question. There's two that stick out to me. One of them, Egypt, in one of the documents that was classified, it said that Egypt is planning to produce 40,000 rockets for Russia. Egypt has denied this, and the White House kind of danced around this, saying that there was no indication that Egypt is providing Russia with deadly weapons. That doesn't mean, that's not exactly answering the question on whether or not they were planning to. Another one I have to point out is on the Wagner Group. Mali was apparently working with the Wagner Group, and the Wagner Group met with Turkish officials trying to purchase weapons and using Mali as a go-between to get those weapons for the war in Ukraine. And now that can be very problematic because that just shows you how much influence the Wagner Group has in Mali. Right. And they've only been in there since 2021. When the junta took over. So that was a big one to watch as well.
I wish we could get through more questions, but I've got a very strict producer here telling me to wrap things up. Thank you so much, Tatenda Gumbo, Kalabab, and Govan Whittles. Thanks to all three of you for joining us. I really, really do appreciate it. And of course, you can find more on all these stories we just discussed on voaafrica.com. That's where Tatenda and her team will make sure you are updated on the latest news across the continent. Still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa, my conversation with Chris Maroleng from Good Governance Africa about the global rising populism and democratic backsliding, and what governance has to do with it. That conversation when Straight Talk Africa returns. We're back in a moment.
Medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. Why has populism been on the rise around the world in recent years? And when does it become a threat to democracy? Chris Maroleng is the executive director of Good Governance Africa. He says many of the trends we're seeing across Africa and in other parts of the world are in large part due to poor governance. Maroleng is from South Africa and recently visited Washington. We sat down for an interview and began our conversation with good governance as a string attached in relations between the United States and African countries.
Well, I would say that there has been a direct mention of issues related to good governance, or rather important to the effective implementation of good governance in Africa, as we have seen, Anthony Blinken coming to South Africa and various parts of Africa. We've also saw Janet Yellen also coming to South Africa and some parts of Africa. And one of their key messages is that the relationship with Africa, especially of the United States, will not necessarily be characterized by the conditionality that underpinned Africa's relationship, or rather United States' relationship with Africa, but it will really be underpinned by mutual respect and understanding that Africa and the various countries that comprise Africa are sovereign states. They have their own interests. They have relations with some of the United States competitors like China and Russia, which are historical, which are underpinned by links that go back to the liberation struggle. And I think there's an increasing nuance and understanding by United States counterparts that the relationship with Africa and African states cannot be one that is marked by a sort of patronage or condescending approach towards the relationship with African countries, but one that must be marked by mutual respect and an understanding that the United States, for a number of reasons, really requires the cooperation and, more importantly, the mutual trust and, I would say, friendship of countries on the African continent.
And as you spoke
about this now that these are sovereign nations, so of course they are to be engaged differently,
right?
But you also mentioned conditionalities that are no longer there. But was good governance not one of those conditionalities in the past? Mm-hmm. Is it no longer one now?
Yeah. I would say it wasn't necessarily good governance, but it was Western liberal democracy, which was one of the sort of challenging points for many African countries who did not necessarily believe that democracy had to take a Western or indeed a liberal approach. Governance, on the other hand, which talks about, you know, who gets what, when and how. It talks about how resources are allocated and that these resources must be allocated in an accountable and transparent fashion in the interest of citizens is something that is very central still to U.S. policy, and that is embraced by many African states who believe that governance must be inclusive, it must be effective.
But because at the same time, we are seeing democratic backsliding, not just on the continent, but this seems to be a global trend. Mm. What's driving it? What's going on?
I think what we're seeing generally, and I'm generalizing globally, is really frustration around the inequality that arises from the way in which the state, not just in Africa, but globally, is really configured. Many people feel disenfranchised, they feel excluded, and as a result, this populism gains greater attractiveness across the world. And as a result, we see this interesting sort of link or correlation between populism and autocracy, where people are saying, you know, this talk of democracy has not resulted in better economic prosperity for the majority of people. Here, for example, in the United States, we saw the rise of Trump and Trumpism, which was a very populist approach towards governance. We see this in many parts of the world, including Africa, where this populist approach, which is accompanied by autocratic forms of governance, seems to be getting a greater traction. However, what we're also seeing is a greater realization by citizens that populism and promises made by politicians does not necessarily lead to good and effective governance. What people want, especially on the African continent, in the main, is governments that are effective, that are inclusive, that practice good governance, that are transparent and accountable. I think most citizens, when you ask them and we look at surveys run by organizations like the Africa Barometer, indicate to us that they may not be calling for, let's call it a democracy in the Western liberal understanding of it, but they do want transparency, they do want accountability, and they do want a voice in the way in which they're governed.
But Chris, I'm curious about this. We also see the biggest and most stable democracies. They are failing in their ability to deliver to their people. Mm. We look at Ghana, which is one of the most stable democracies on the continent, known for that, in economic turmoil. South Africa, the electricity crisis, amid a deepening unemployment crisis. What is the fallout? What are we staring in the face here?
You know, in many ways, this is explained by some of the studies we do at Good Governance Africa. We have what is known as a governance index. And what it demonstrates to us is that we really need to understand the flavor of the form of governance that we see in what you have described as some of the better or more effective governance states in Africa. On the one hand, in Rwanda, we see effective delivery of services, a highly effective state. But on the other hand, in Rwanda, we see citizen voice and democratic space narrowed in that country. But at the other side of the scale, in South Africa, for example, we see great citizen voice, right, and democratic practice, but the effectiveness of the state to deliver services like electricity has really been underpinned by a lack of capacity in the state to do this. One thing that we can generalize about is that if you look 30 years back, 40 years back, democratic space has increased. Citizen voice has also increased in Africa. And I'm not just saying this because Chris is saying this. I'm saying this based on empirical studies that have been carried out. So there is an increasing awareness by those who would govern, that citizens require greater accountability, transparency. They want to participate in their citizens. And one of the key vehicles to do this is civil society. So in many states in Africa, we do see increasing participation and actions by civil society. And these must be differentiated from political parties. Mm-hmm. Civil society really are comprised of non-governmental entities that are not political parties that do, in one way or the other, sort of champion open and even democratic systems on the African continent. They, in the main, including us, Good Governance Africa, call for effective governance of the state because we understand that good governance is good for socioeconomic development. We also believe that civil society has played a crucial role in helping the government and states understand that it is only through positioning the private sector as partners for development that the state and governments in Africa can effectively grow and become the kind of developed countries that we want to move Africa upwards to in the main.
Do you think that in the places where we do see greater participation in civil society, that's largely driven by a younger generation? Is there a generational aspect to it?
Absolutely. I think there is a definite generational aspect for it. I think a lot of the younger generations really do believe, because they're more connected globally to various trends, and they have a different approach to the way in which they perceive authority. I think, you know, I know you're still very young. Older generations like myself really did defer towards authority. And they did understand that the relationship between those who would govern and the governed was an imbalanced relationship.
Right.
Increasingly, governance, or rather good and effective governance, is trying to balance that scale between the governed and those who would govern, not just in Africa, but I think globally, because there is contestation, as we discussed earlier, about the position of the citizen in the state and how this imbalance and inequitable system that results in populist kind of governance or governments emerging that are very autocratic in nature cannot be the future of the world. And certainly in Africa, we argue that this cannot be the future of our continent, because we note that states that are badly governed result in negative outcomes for the citizen.
Chris, in the interest of accurate journalism and fair and balanced reporting, I have to say I am older than you might think, and I'm sure you're younger than you're making yourself out to be. But you know, Chris, many African countries have had independence since the 1960s. That's one thing that many African countries do have in common. They've had independence since the 1960s, in the 70s, in the 80s. Yep. Why are we still discussing governance today? Why is there still a struggle with that? What stands in the way of any government's ability to govern well, govern effective, and deliver for their people?
Because I think when we look at the sort of evolution of governance in the African state, I think when you talk of the 60s and periods before this, the post-colony, so to speak, it was really characterized by the failure of the state in and of itself to decolonize. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean that the tendencies of exclusion, of autocracy, of lack of transparency and accountability, where government and indeed heads of state were seen as these kings who were infallible and could not be challenged, did not evolve. And as a result, the African state in and of itself took up some of these negative tendencies from the colonial past. I think given the evolution of time, you know, your question is so essential. And that is why I am saying to you that governance must be something that we continually ask for from our leaders, from the state, the various states in the African continent, because we effectively believe that by calling for good and effective governance that delivers to the citizens of our African continent, we can really forge a better future for the people of Africa.
And that was Chris Moroleng. He's the executive director of Good Governance Africa, who was speaking to me here in Washington. And that is it for us this week. Thank you so much for watching and for always listening. I'll see you next time. Goodbye.